This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Joyful, joyful.
Spirit Lounge on Joy 94.9. This is the show where we talk about spirituality and sexuality for our community.
Good evening, faithful listeners. You're listening to the Spirit Lounge here on Joy 94.9 every Thursday from 8 until 9. And I am joined by my lovely co-host, Rachel. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, everybody.
So we're going to be talking about a few things. Later on, we're actually be going to talk about we're going to be talking to Grant Morrison. Now, Rachel Morrison, do you have any idea who Grant Morrison might be?
Look, I might be a little familiar with this man. He's actually my dad. He's a pretty wonderful person and has some incredible stories to share with us tonight.
That's great. People will be like, oh, how'd you get him? And so, I wonder how we did that. Well, we'll be talking to Grant later. I'm very excited. But first, we'll actually be going to fairly extensively be covering our holy day of the week.
I feel like we need a little sound clip there when we announce our holy day of the week.
That's
actually be something exciting.
That's a good idea. I might get one prepared where I'll be like, ba-da-ba-ba-ba, holy day of the week. Yeah.
Yes.
I'll try and actually get, maybe if it's just that exact recording,
yeah,
or I just do it like that for a while. But this is quite an interesting one because it is a holy day for quite a few religions. And it's a secular holiday as well. So it's actually called Nowruz. There's a few different spellings of it. So it's like Nowruz. So I'm not quite sure. And it also depends on what country you're from, how exactly it's pronounced. But just so everyone knows, I'm going to be collectively calling it Nowruz.
Perfect.
That's what we're going to be calling it. Nowruz is actually the first day of the Persian calendar, and it stands for New Day on March 21st. So March 21st, according to the Persian calendar, is basically it's New Year's Day.
Yeah.
Which is great. So, you know, when we get there, I wish a happy Nowruz to all our Persian listeners. But so it's actually in Iran itself these days for most people of Persian heritage. It's basically a secular holiday.
Yeah.
Right. It's really, again, I guess like New Year's.
Like our New Year's Day.
Yeah. It's a secular holiday, but it really has very interesting roots. It's not as simple as just being like, oh, the Persian calendar's New Year's. Oh, so it's like a New Year's, blah, blah, blah. So it actually has its roots in antiquity, with the Babylonian and Persian kings participating in Nowruz festivals. So you would actually have to, it's really, that would be the allocated time where you weren't officially the king until that festival was finished. And yeah, you were sort of king at the beginning of the year, and until that you were there sitting in between kings. So it's kind of like when someone's voted to become prime minister or president, but then there's a gap before they actually take their vows or whatever it is in different countries. That was the day.
There you go. So it's a very exciting holiday.
Yeah, it's got some pretty ancient things, but it's also still a holy day for Zoroastrians.
Yes.
So Zoroastrians are probably something, and this is what we want to be doing on the Spirit Lounge and covering, is some religions where probably a lot of the audience is going, I've never heard of Zoroastrians before.
Yeah, but lucky for us, we have someone who knows a little bit about Zoroastrians.
I do. Thank you. Thank you for that, Rachel. So I do know a little about Zoroastrians. So I wanted to at least let people know a little bit more about them, just so that I'm not like, yeah, there's these people named Zoroastrians and it's their new day.
Yeah, so where did it come from?
All right, so Zoroastra was a Persian religious philosopher ancient times, who basically was known, he simplified the pantheon of gods from the sort of Babylonian gods, and basically summarized it like this. There's two forces. There's a destructive force and there's a creative force, and both sit under a single force or god, basically. So it's quite fascinating because Zoroastrian is then a major influence on then the Abrahamic faiths later. So one, of course, the element of monotheism. This isn't quite monotheism in the way that we understand it, but it's worth noting it's not as simple as just saying there's polytheism and monotheism. It doesn't quite work that way. There's a lot of in-between.
Yes.
And this is definitely, there's a lot of influences here. And again, the other part is the dualism. The idea of there being this negative, there's this destructive force and this creative force that are constantly in conflict. This is pretty much this idea that we later on see of like gods and devils.
Yeah, and in every religion and spirituality, regardless of what they know about, like Western culture or any culture, they have that good versus evil. So
yeah, many of them do. Especially the idea that they're somewhat independent. So some would say now that we have this sort of idea that there's God, but then there's a devil. We'll just say a devil generally, or like Satan or whatever. There's some sort of character.
Evil being.
That may or may not be still subservient to God, if you've ever had that idea.
Yes.
This is different. This is really like you're looking at two separate forces that are in this constant conflict. So one, I'll backtrack a bit. Basically, if you look, in Judaism, we don't really have a concept of Satan.
Mm-hmm.
There is an angel called Satan, which basically translates as he's really the devil's advocate. Actually, really, the devil's advocate is a term that applies to the devil in Judaism. So it's actually an angel whose job is to test people.
Okay.
But for God. If
right.
that makes sense.
Yes, and so he's just the bad guy that sits on your left hand shoulder or whatever.
But that's right, but it's really not supposed to be in conflict with God. So you actually then see that I think the idea is that if we were to go up to the holy courts, you know, when it's like, will I get into heaven?
Yes.
He's like your prosecutor,
okay.
And then there's another angel who's your defendant.
But he's not necessarily trying to kill you type bad guy.
It's worth noting that in this concept, that is that angel's job.
Yeah, it's an equal to the god, to the good, I should say.
Yes, that's right. So in that case, it's like this is a job. This is a bit different where this is that idea that there's this force of evil, there's this destroyer, but there's also this good force and you're always wanting to, they're in sort of constant conflict. And it's like, what will happen at the end of all that? So there's huge influences. And it's worth noting that Zoroastrianism is basically the common ancestor between the Abrahamic faiths, but then also Hinduism. So because it's from Iran, so it's sort of that Indo-Middle East area. So it's a bit in between. And that's where you see that common ancestor. So it's worth noting that even though we talk about these forces, the reason I want to say forces and not God is because to some degree it's sort of a bit of a, it's not clear that these are necessarily conscious beings, and it's got that nature element to it. So of course there are many religions where we sort of don't think of the gods as being conscious beings, like in Abrahamic faiths, but you think of them as being forces of nature, like, or spiritual powers.
Fire, wind, water.
It can sometimes be a bit like that, not quite. But you see a bit of all of this in Zoroastrianism, and it's of course changed over time. And if I brought in a Zoroastrian here today, they would probably look at me and be like, you are wrong on absolutely every front. And that's the struggle of trying to talk about different religions. But I think that sort of gives you a great idea that you're really talking about, and it still exists today. Very small. We're really looking in the, I think, really just a couple of 100,000 who sort of live in around India and Iran. They are the two areas. So just to exactly get it. I wanted to note another influence that they've major had, which is the idea of purification rituals that revolve around fire. So if anyone's ever heard of the idea of people having fire gods or worshipping fire, or that there's these people in that sort of Iran area that have these fire gods around, if you've ever heard that, people are referring to Zoroastrians. Now, it's worth noting that they don't really worship fire. That would be like saying that Catholics worship holy water. It doesn't work. That doesn't make sense. Or that Hindus worship cows. Like, it's just not that. Just because we say something sacred or special or holy, it doesn't mean that it's a god.
Yes, that's not
Yeah, and that's worth noting. But and the whole idea of that things are purified in fire is a Zoroastrian idea. And we actually see it carry over into ancient Judaism. If you really look at the Bible, you see these ideas of that things are purified when they pass through fire. Yes. And only if they can't, like people, do we instead use water.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically... So actually, in order to kosher a kitchen...
Sense.
In order to order a kosher a kitchen, even now, you use like hot rings that have been like burning, metal rings that have been like burning hot, and you actually put them on the pans and stuff like that. The idea of religiously purifying things with like great heat is, for most of us, this stems from Zoroastrianism.
That is amazing.
So yeah, it's worth knowing about them, because sometimes they get sort of kicked out of because they're not Abrahamic, they get kicked out of the monotheist club, and it ends up being like Jews, Christians, Muslims, and the Zoroastrians are sometimes a bit like, but you all were inspired by us, and we're like, oh, that's cute.
Yeah.
But
you're just too ancient.
Yeah, and too ancient for us. So I wanted to do a little call out to our Zoroastrians. I don't know what else to... There's so much I could go on about them specifically, but I will leave it there for now, because they're not even the only ones that celebrate.
That's exciting.
Nowruz. But if you're a Zoroastrian, you're celebrating Nowruz.
Happy Nowruz.
Much like Happy Nowruz. And I know you guys are getting out rose water, maybe even some wine, different things like that. And I'd like to wish you a very happy Nowruz. Good evening, faithful listeners. You're listening to The Spirit Lounge here on Joy 94.9. And we've been talking about Nowruz. We were talking about the Zoroastrians.
Yeah.
Something. But
so
like
tell.
Yes.
Sorry.
Yes, Rachel.
I just wanted to ask you, who else celebrates Nowruz?
Well, it's funny you say that. Well, I picked one. How did you know that I had another one? We picked one very ancient group that celebrates Zoroastrianism. But there's another group, which is a very new faith, sort of in part of that 19th century 19th century group of newer religions. But the other one is the Baha'i,
yes,
which celebrate Nowruz. So, again, the Baha'i are another group. There's only about 300,000 Baha'i in Australia, so certainly not many people have heard of them, and they vary about, you know, equally as small proportionally around the world. Very, very small religion. Also, of course, originating out of Iran. So again, we see it's that same area which is then picked it up. So my basic summary of the Baha'i faith is that the Baha'u'llah, who was at... So first we had a group, a man called the Bab, and he predicted that there was going to be this sort of new prophet of God, a somewhat messianic figure, but I don't quite want to call it that, and we'll sort of get there... I'll sort of unpack that in a moment. But then later on, we had the Baha'u'llah. And so the Baha'u'llah was a kind of messianic figure in 1852, and he founded this new religion, which we call the Baha'i faith. And the most important thing to understand, I mean, they come from Islamic backgrounds, but the most important thing to understand about the Baha'u'llah and the Baha'i is this idea of progressive revelation. So what I want to say with this new religion, it a lot of its founders were originally, and a lot of its ancestors were originally Muslim, but it's worth noting this idea of progressive revelation. So I guess the best way I would put it as is that there is an idea, and, you know, some Christians, of course, have shied away from it because of certain awkward implications, but this idea that we had Judaism, and then Jesus came along, and then due to that, Judaism became somewhat obsolete, and now Christianity is the completion, and that's it. Right? You certainly have some people that have this idea.
Yeah.
Then later on, we have the Prophet Muhammad, and he comes along and says, okay, you had all this other stuff, and that was great, and that was true, But now this has come along. This is Islam. It is the completion of the idea of new prophets. And this is the last one, and Islam is it. In the case of the Baha'i, it incorporates this idea that that God has appeared to different groups at all times, when appropriate, in different visions, and no matter what religion it is. So whether or not it be the different spirituality groups of Native Americans, whether or not it be indigenous tribes in Australia, whether or not it be the Abrahamic faiths, whether or not it be the Zoroastrians, the ancient Babylonians, everything, God appeared to them and revealed themselves in a way that was appropriate to that time. And that the Baha'i is now the new appropriate revelation. And that this is the best sort of manifestation for our time. But the key to that understanding is that this is not permanent. That in 1,000 years or so, there will be a new prophet or a new revelation that will be the new one.
Okay.
And that's sort of an important distinction to understand, unlike other faiths that have maybe come along.
Will they remain as the Baha'i then, or do they become a whole new religion?
Maybe not. I don't know, but
Stay tuned and we'll find out.
Exactly. Better. So I thought it was worth understanding, and that's why I said also the idea of a messiah is a bit touch and go. I don't quite want to say that it's a messiah, because that sort of implies that there's sort of a golden age that has been completed.
Yeah.
So that's a bit of a, I think, the most important thing to understand about the Baha'i. But the, so basically the Baha'i celebrate Nowruz for a very different reason. It actually immediately follows after the Baha'i month of fasting. So there's a month of fasting, and it ends right around Nowruz.
So a similar time to Lent as well.
Yeah. Yes, actually. It's sort of, in many cases, again, you can see there's elements of Lent here. There's also elements of, oh my goodness, I'm totally, what's the month of fasting in Islam? I can't remember what, I've had a completely blank, I'm so sorry, but I'm sure many of the, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. Someone's going to write in, I'm sure, and be like, come on, Tal, you should know. But I'm very, very sorry, I've drawn a blank. But it comes from these different times. Nowruz is when it finishes for the Baha'i, at the beginning of the new year. And so it's a festival for those people who have completed. So again, for our Baha'i audience who is out there, and even if you're not our audience, just out there, the Baha'i, I wish you again a happy Nowruz. I hope you fasted well, and please celebrate wonderfully.
So we've gotten a message in saying, Tal, where are the Baha'i free to practice?
That is actually, it's worth noting, I can tell from the number, that's actually my dad. He's clearly listening in, and he is leading me on. Well, I'm glad to notice that. So the Baha'i, you sometimes see the Baha'i a little bit in India. You see the Baha'i in Iran. Many, though, of course, left Iran. It was very difficult, and they have a long history of oppression in the region. And the other area that they are in, so there are two major temples, two of the major temples that I understand. There's one in India, and the other one is in Israel. And it's actually in Haifa, and I visited the Baha'i Gardens. So there's these beautiful gardens there in the Baha'i Gardens, and that's also where the sort of major... The Baha'i are quite fascinating. They have this universal house of justice. So there's actually a... There's not a single leader of the Baha'i. There's a voted, like, council, and they change every 5 years, I think, 4 or 5 years. So, and... Almost every position of leadership is changed every 4 or 5 years with the Baha'i. And so then it's interesting. So there's quite a large population of Baha'i in Israel, but they're not permanent residents, because they just come just for that period of time, and then they leave afterwards.
Wow.
So it's quite a fascinating one, where there's many, many Baha'is in Haifa, but almost none of them are permanent residents.
Amazing.
Which is just because that they're there while they're actually serving their time, and then they leave. But if you look up the Baha'i Gardens, the other one is the Lotus Temple, is something else worth looking up. You can just see their fascinating architecture. Yeah, well, the Lotus, it kind of looks like the Sydney Opera House, but it's not, of course. It's this beautiful, it looks like a lotus. It's a giant lotus temple.
Amazing. And to our Islamic listeners, it's Ramadan. Sorry that we forgot.
Yes. Oh, God. I'm sorry. Yes, someone did write into me. Okay. Thank you very much. I can't believe I blanked on that. I'm very, very sorry for forgetting that one. But we're actually going to leave you with a song for the holiday. Everyone who's celebrating Nowruz. This is a song that I found. It's a Persian song about Nowruz. And this is really something which, I'll tell you what, if Iran participated in the Eurovision Song Contest, I would expect it to sound something down. Like, it would be something like this for sure. So you're listening to The Spirit Lounge on Joy 94.9, and we are listening to Nowruz by Hamoun and Ramtin.
And you're on Spirit Lounge on Joy 94.9. And as we mentioned earlier, our special guest is someone even more special to me tonight. So we have my dad, Grant Morrison, tonight, who has been living over in the Solomon Islands and working with other Pacific Islands, doing leadership training and empowering people, islanders over there. So welcome to the show, Dad.
Thanks, Rachel.
Good to have you here. So, can you just tell us about the countries that you work in and why you decided to connect with the Pacific Islands?
All right. So, the first of the countries that I work in and where I spent most of my time is the Solomon Islands. But I've also worked and trained people in Vanuatu, Fiji, Papua New Guinea, Tonga. I've been over to Nauru and... there's another couple of island nations I'd like to get to this year, is Kiribati and New Caledonia. So they're the countries that we work in, and how I ended up being there, was that the other question?
What made you decide to connect with the Pacific Islands?
Well, it's actually my wife, Sue, or your mother.
Surprise!
So Sue got a job... as an advisor working for the government and funded by the Australian government. The first job wasn't funded by the Australian government. It was actually funded by the Commonwealth Secretariat. And it was in the Solomon Islands. And so we went and just fell in love with the people and connected really well with the people. And so that was in 2010. So we were there 2010, 2011. That contract finished. We came back to Australia. But I continued to work with Solomon Island people. And then we went back and have just spent the last 2 years living in the Solomon Islands. And I expanded what I was doing from beyond the Solomon Islands at that point in time to right across the South Pacific, mainly focusing on Melanesian people.
That's awesome. So can you tell us a bit about the history of spirituality in the Solomon Islands specifically?
All right. Well, Solomon Island people have been around for a long time and originally were animist ancestor worshippers. And so right across all of the 800-plus islands in the Solomons, everyone were animist. Cannibals, and cannibalism only finished less than 100 years ago in the Solomon Islands. And actually in the 16th century, the first white people to visit the Solomon Islands were a Spanish captain by the name of Mendana. So that was the first encounter that Solomon Islanders had with people who had different spiritual beliefs. And actually, this man, Mendana, gave Solomon Islands its name that it's known as today because Mendana is a good Catholic. When he went to the river on the island of Guadalcanal and one of his men was panning for gold just to see if it's what sort of resources were there, they found gold so easily that they believed that the Solomon Islands was the place of King Solomon's mine.
Wow.
So are there still traditional beliefs that have lasted till today, or has that largely been now obliterated?
Yeah, well, there's, there were always some traditional, practices that are held, but on the island of Malaita, which is the most populous island, there is still some tribal groups. They call them custom villages. It's about 5% of the population still live in really the same conditions that there would have been back when Mendana first came to the Solomon Islands. So they are pretty much naked. They still practice animism, have had some of them, in those villages, they've never seen a white person. So that's about 5% of the population are animist and fall into that category.
And there's still part of the Solomon Islands that people can't access as well because the mountains are so large and stuff. And they're, like, I know that there are still beliefs that there are people up in those mountains. Like, is that a common belief that there are still people that haven't even been discovered by white people yet?
In the Solomon Islands, there's stories of giants and also of small people in other islands. So they, and this is dense jungle with very steep mountains, and part of the reason why these custom villages still exist is that they're in fairly inaccessible places, and there may well be in their stories, particularly in the island of Malaita, that there are groups of people that are still hidden there that they call the giants. So that may well be true.
Even if even not excluding those that are from, I don't know what you'd call them, isolated communities is sometimes, mm-hmm. I guess, what we use when we refer to South America. But even without that, do we see much preservation of traditional culture, even if it's since been mixed?
If you were to go to Solomon Islands, you would be greeted in a traditional manner. There would be, they usually have playing at the airport, a bamboo pipe band. So there's still very much a strong influence of traditional music and traditional dancing and traditional art. Those things are very, very strong in the western province of the Solomon Islands. They have excellent wood carvers. They're as good a wood carvers as you would find anywhere. And so a lot of those traditional skills continue on. They still use shell money is still recognized in the Solomon Islands. And they still make shell money by traditional methods as well. So there are still a lot of traditional elements. Most people in the Solomon Islands still live in a traditional village and still have their small garden and would fish and live basically from day to day with very few Western improvements, with the exception of mobile phones. They're everywhere. Mobile phones, they've made it everywhere.
Yes. Can we just backtrack a bit?
Yep.
Can you tell me a bit more about shell, like shell currency?
Yeah.
What are we talking about here? As in, I guess what I'm wondering is how come someone can't run to the beach and then be very wealthy? Like, it's just an honest question. Yeah, just honest question. How does that actually maintain itself?
Yeah. Well, the shell money that's made in Malaita, and it's just made in one area in the Langa Langa Lagoon, and so they get particular shells, then they break them into pieces and sort them, and then they drill a hole in them, and then they roll them until they're round, about the size of maybe
your pinky fingernail,
half the size of a 5-cent piece.
Oh, wow.
But it's still quite small, and then they string them together, And if you get red shells, which are harder to find, red shells are worth more. And so they make, you know, long strands, but they also make some other spectacular patterns. And so in most marriages, particularly involving Melaitans, there's an exchange of shell money. And there in the Western Solomon Islands, there are different shells, like big clam shells are being carved into particular shapes. So that's the shell money that you use. It's not quite, let me just go down to the beach and grab some shells. There's a lot of work has gone in.
Yeah, they're still designed in such a way that really you can't, I don't know, quote-unquote, counterfeit them. Like there's still kind of a mint in a sense that still actually produces particular shells for trade.
Yeah, that's correct.
That's amazing.
Oh, and it's the most fascinating process to watch as well. I was fortunate enough to be able to see some ladies making shell money, and the effort that goes into it is just spectacular. And some of the shell money is what you see people wearing around their necks, just like shell necklaces made out of little white shells, is actually currency in Solomon Island countries.
So can I quickly ask, if people, when people aren't using that, what is the currency?
So there's the Solomon Island dollar, and most transactions are undertaken using Solomon Island dollars, like as we would understand money. But you can still, like your bride price, which is paid in shell money, is many thousands of dollars, which can be sold to, so that the bride's family can be compensated if the marriage doesn't work out. But for most transactions, it's nearly always normal Solomon Island currency.
Okay. Yep. So your title there is a movements leader. Yep. So how would you describe what exactly that is that you do?
Okay. Well, I'm working to see church planting movements happen right across the South Pacific, and so that's my title is it's shortened from church planting movements leader. So I want to see churches that begin churches that begin churches that begin churches, and to do that, I train people so that they would be disciples who reproduce disciples who reproduce disciples who reproduce disciples, and so it continues on. So it's not the work of one person to build the church. It's the work of everyone who's in the church. So it's the work of the church to begin another church. Every church beginning a church that begins a church that begins a church. So, and that's movement.
Yeah, so are you really just empowering church leaders, or are you like working with everyone within churches, and are they predominantly male? Because in some cultures that aren't as progressive as Western cultures, like the men are number one.
Yep, all right. Well, in the Solomon Islands, most of the time the men are number one. but that's not always true. But I'm not working just with church leaders. I am looking for people who put the training that I run into practice, and then I'm looking for the best of the leaders out of those. They may or may not be existing church leaders. And my best workers are those who are on the fringe of the church, rather than those who are already in the middle of, you know, like they're pastoring a church or something like that. They already have other commitments and their time is filled. So I'm really looking for people who have the time to give, to be out telling other people about Jesus. When I run training, if I don't say I want young people and women to be at the training as well, it will be all men and it'll just be pastors. So I'm very clear when I'm organising the training and promoting it that it's open for everyone. Otherwise, it would just be a male-dominated thing. And so I'm looking for women who are leaders as well. And so I'm up for training and working with men and women. At this point in time, most of those who I've got are men who I'm working with, but not all of them. And some of the people I'm working with are young people as well. So I'm, you know, happy. Men, women, young people, old people, just people who are committed to what I'm training people in.
And we are talking to a little person that we like to call Grant. Hi, Grant. And we've been talking a little. Grant actually does various missionary work in the Solomon Islands. And we've been talking about some of the different things that he has been engaged in there.
Yeah, so we know that education and resources are often inaccessible in countries such as the Solomon Islands and other Pacific Islands who are not first world countries. How can you share the Bible with them if they don't have access to Bibles? And even if they are lucky enough to have one, probably can't read it.
Yes, yeah, good question. And because the cultures that I'm working in, this whole Melanesian culture is very much an oral culture. So people are just wonderful at telling stories. So I train people to be able to retell Bible stories from memory. And so if they come to my training, they would leave with half a dozen to ten stories from the Bible that they've learned off by heart. It's actually not that complicated once you begin to do it. And because they're used to telling stories, they find it quite easy to do. And I've trained a number of illiterate people who have mainly been ladies, and they've just loved being able to go back and retell the stories. And so just so long as there's someone connected in that network who has access to a Bible and can read it and then continue to train others, we just use that simple process of retelling Bible stories as accurately as we can from memory. Everyone does that, whether they can read or not.
I was wondering, because you were mentioning earlier, I mean, there's quite a lot of islands. How similar is the language between different islands?
Well, there are a lot of different languages in the Solomon Islands. Off the top of my head, I can't remember how many. So most Solomon Island people who live in, say, the capital of Honiara, who speak some English. English would be at least their third or fourth language. So everyone would speak their tribal language, and then they speak Pidgin, and then English. So maybe the tribal language of Mum and the tribal language of Dad, then Pidgin, then English. So English is meant to be the language of trade, but in effect it's Pidgin. So pretty much everyone will be able to speak Pidgin, and that's how they communicate. So while I was over there, I learned to speak Pidgin. Any training that I did in Pidgin went far better than anything I did in English.
So the Pidgin is a bit of a combination, and that's kind of the name you're using for the combination sort of between English and local languages, all a bit mixed together?
Yeah, it's got a lot. It's mainly a simplified English. It's meant to be a simpler sentence structure. It's a different sentence structure than when we would be speaking English. And then there are some language words that are thrown in there, and other words that you know, you can look at them and work out, oh, they had an English root. But as the Solomon Islanders heard people speaking English say it, what they said back was similar but a little bit different, and it grew into this language called Pidgin. So Solomon Islands Pidgin is a little bit different to PNG Pidgin or Vanuatu Pidgin, but if you can speak one of those, you could be understood in any of those countries.
Now, I wanted to ask, you said about 5% of the Solomon Islands still is a sort of traditional animist background. What is everyone else?
Well, there's about another 3% of non-Christian religions, so Islam, Baha'i, and some other Buddhist left and things like that. But pretty much 92% of the population is Christian. But that's nominally Christian. You wouldn't say it's not 92% actively involved in church life or anything like that. But it's now predominantly a Christian country. So it's said 92%. Yeah.
So how? What's the actual in terms of those? Which sort of sects are we seeing of Christianity?
The major denominations are Catholic, Anglican, and South Seas Evangelical Church, and which grew out of missionary work in the Solomon Islands, is a evangelical denomination, somewhat aligned to Baptist. And then the next largest denomination would be Seventh-day Adventist after that.
So Catholic, are you saying that Catholic is actually the largest group?
It may be Anglican, which is called Church of Melanesia.
Right.
So those two and SSEC are by far and away the three largest denominations. So I'm not exactly sure what the, off the top of my head, what the breakdown of those is.
Is the Catholic influence in Solomon Islands from the... a more colonial Spanish heritage?
Yeah, from Mendino.
No. It's come through Europeans, and the western part of the Solomon Islands was a German protectorate, so it's come through German roots. But the bishop of the Solomon Islands, a lovely Catholic man, Bishop Adrian, is Irish.
Oh.
Wow. There's quite a combination there going, even in terms of its just Catholic alone, let alone the fact that that is just a small part of the variations of religion in Solomon Islands.
Yeah. Well, one of the early missionary martyrs in the Solomon Islands was the first Anglican bishop of the Solomon Islands, a man by the name of Patterson, and in about... 1871, he went off to another island and they killed him in 18. And he was the bishop.
Wow. So if I was going to Solomon Islands, do you have any recommendations, any highlights for me?
Any highlights? I would say you need to leave Honiara to get out to really see what the Solomon Islands is like. So definitely. Honiara is just like any other, pretty much any other city. I mean, it's a poor third world city, but the real Solomon Islands is very beautiful. So you need to get across to one of the other islands or another part of the island of Guadalcanal. That would be one highlight. Another thing, the island of Guadalcanal in World War II was a major battle, Americans versus Japanese, and was a pivotal even for Australia in World War II. So there is a lot of World War II history to be seen and experienced in the Solomon Islands. That would be another thing. I would say if you're there for a Sunday, you want to go to a local church, one without white people in it, and just be part of hearing the Solomon Islanders sing. They're just so passionate when they sing. Definitely something you want to be a part of.
Well, thank you very much, Grant, for speaking with us tonight on the Spirit Lounge. That's all very interesting, and it sounds like I really need to get on to the Solomon Islands. All right, faithful listeners, we've come to the end of another episode of the Spirit Lounge here on Joy 94.9. We hope to have you listening to us next Thursday, and so that's goodbye from Tal.
And goodbye from Rachel.
You can find more Joycasts and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.